Namaste. So we are starting the session with a practical, or rather basic practice of the yoga of the Gita, which is samatvam, to practice equanimity in all conditions, heat and cold, at least some degree of. This is the practice actually. People often ask, what is the practice? So this is the practice. So, amid the varying changes of life, to look at the one immutable presence, which is dwells in all things, in all situations, in all events and circumstances. This is the first basic practice. All the rest comes later. So, we are entering into chapter 15 of Essays on the Gita. And the chapter is now, it's Sri Aurobindo's birth month, and we have three chapters which we'll read during this month. So it's very gratifying. It's like the stamp and seal of Sri Aurobindo on the efforts that he's making us do. All these three chapters, they are about, as the Gita itself describes and Sri Aurobindo confirms it, the highest mystery of existence. And the highest mystery of existence is that God does not run this world in absentia. He enters into it. He not only enters into it as a witness, but he also governs the flow and flux of time from behind the veil in human beings. Not only does he govern from behind the veil, but from time to time he steps into the forefront. And that is a great mystery, because it gives hope. And it's a mystery because he assumes a human form and shape. So before he comes as an avatar, which is what an avatar is, he does help this world and mankind through several vibhutis, sages, saints who set an example. Never has been a time when something of this yoga has not been practiced. And we had the examples of specifically King Janak, whose story I was supposed to share. So King Janak, as we know, is not one king, but a lineage of kings. And they practice this yoga. The famous one is because Mata Sita's father, and he was the king of Mithila. So during those days, we had mainly these two great kingdoms. The kingdom of Ayodhya, it was called Ayodhya because it could never be conquered. Ayodhya. It didn't have to fight a war because nobody would dare fight a war with Ayodhya. Ayodhya, that's how it was. And it was established way back, thousands of years back. And then the other was Mithila. And if you go down, there was Kishkindha, which was by, Vanara were not monkeys, they were humans, but living in the forest. And they would often wear monkey dress and these things. It's all documented. And they had very much the same culture like the people up north. And then there was the southern part, which was largely all kinds of people would come here and there, and it was under attack during Sri Rama's time by the Rakshasas and Asuras who wanted to conquer it, Dandakaranya and below. And that's when Sri Rama goes and establishes a whole India at that point of time. So, much before that, there is the lineage of kings who were practicing this yoga. And among them is a lineage called Janak. And this is a very fascinating story about Janak. And the story goes that once sees a dream in which he is very thirsty, very hungry. He is desperate about water and he is not getting water anywhere. He wants food and he is not getting. Then he goes into a hut. Some knocks the door and a lady offers him some khichdi to eat. So he is wanting to eat, and some, you know, as it happens, a bird flies by and the whole plate, it gets overturned. So now it everything is mixes into mud. So he is very tormented that, oof, why this has happened. And then he wakes up. So when he wakes up, he finds he's in the palace, and first he has the typical sigh of comfort, thank God. But then he questions, is it that time that was so real? In the dream, his thirst is real, his hunger is real, everything is so real. Now I feel this is real. So what is real? So he starts questioning reality. And he moves day and night. He is seized with this quest. What is reality? Till he meets that time his mentor. Because the lineage. So this one of the stories. What is mentor? Astavakra. Astavakra himself is called Astavakra. Because Vakra means who is Tidameda. Who is a bit crooked. Crooked in his body. His body was twisted at 8 places. Because when he was in the womb, it seems he corrected a verse which his father was speaking. His father got very angry and annoyed. And he cursed him. You dare correct me? You will be born twisted. So he was born twisted. But then he turned it into his great strength. Because he could never identify himself with the body and grew greatly inside, which is a wonderful story that it's not the body but your inner self which you can grow into. And he was regarded as a Brahmagyani. He comes to the king's court and king asks him, what is real? That me or this me? And he says, neither. Now he is totally confused. He says, neither. He says, then pray tell me what is reality? He says, I can't tell you like this. You have to give me something. Because after all, I am going to give you wisdom. Okay, take as many gold coins, as many. He says, these are not yours. Are they yours? And he realizes they are not mine. They belong to the kingdom. Today it's with me. Tomorrow it'll be with somebody else. He says, okay, you can take this palace, live there. He says, that's also not yours. Kingdom is not yours. Ultimately, he realizes nothing is mine. So he gets the first realization. He says, what shall I give then? He says, you give yourself because you are the one who wants to get the knowledge. So he says, what do you mean by giving myself? And Astavakra tells him, to give yourself means you surrender to me. That's called giving. Now you won't question me. I'll give you the knowledge. This is the condition of knowledge. So he says, okay, I won't question you. Now give me the Atma Gyan. He says, well, for everything there is a time and place. So, place I will tell you. It can't be done here. It has to be done in my hermitage at my place. In the forest where there is no disturbance. So he says, okay, I'll come there. But then by this time, king says, see, look here, I have engaged in enough discussion already. And while I respect you so much and I want the Brahma Gyan, but I'm in a hurry because I have to govern the kingdom. Okay, I'm a trustee, but still I have to look after. So can you give me that knowledge of the self in that much time as one straddles across a horse? You put the saddle, put your 1 foot and go across. In that much time, can you give me? I can spare that time. He says, yes, that's enough. Okay? So, he goes out. There are little variations of the story, but anyways, he goes there and he says, now I have come to the right place. He has come with his horse. He says, okay, now straddle your horse. He doesn't give him any instruction. Okay. As he puts the saddle, as he puts 1 foot and he's about to climb across, he says, wait, I'll come. He goes. And he doesn't come. Now he has surrendered. So he's to obey. He has agreed that I'll obey. So he's waiting. And one day, 2 days, everybody is worried. They all come. They start speaking to the king and the king doesn't say a word. What are you doing? Have you gone crazy? He doesn't say a word. He is just fixed in that position. 3 days pass. Now they are very worried. They look around. Finally, they find Astavakra and they say, what have you done to our king? Okay, I'll come. So when he comes, he says, okay, Janak, you go across, sit on the horse. So now he sits and converses with him. By then he already has the Brahmagyan. He simply surrendered, obeyed, and while he was in one spot, because he was full of that quest, he has come all the way giving everything, accepted the guidance from a man who is seemingly an object of mockery by others, and he has the Brahmagyan. So such were the kings who at one point of time governed what we today know as India. And that's how Shri Krishna begins chapter 4. Now we are entering into chapter 4. He declares passingly who he is. Because see, when we read a book, so we have many translations. Often I use this as an analogy and sometimes with a little bit of emphasis. When they say that, you know, we have this translation of the Gita, that translation of the Gita. So I say this is Sri Aurobindo's essays on the Gita. So what difference does it make? It makes a difference. Sri Aurobindo has realized identity with Krishna. So in Indian thought, these things are important because we don't believe everybody thinks, everybody philosophizes. So everybody is on the same level. Anybody can write on the Gita and... No, somebody who has realized is the one who is truly the adhikari to give a book like that, work like that. So Sri Krishna must declare his credentials, so to say. Up till now, Arjun knows him as a friend. He has asked him that, please tell me what I should do and what I shouldn't do. And he starts revealing things. But before he can go further, Sri Krishna takes a moment, opportunity to say who he is, who is declaring this. Because you can't just believe, you may enter into all kinds of discussions and arguments. So he starts by saying, I have given this yoga in the beginning to Vivaswan. Who is Vivaswan? So for each, you know, cycle of time, you have the sun god, and the sun god is Vivaswan for this cycle. Why? What is sun god? What has God got to do this with it? It means that all the suns in this particular cycle of time. So there are several suns. Science now says that our sun is one of the suns. All of them which are at the center of different, you know, planetary systems. So there is a master force and a being, not just a force, who governs all these. Evidence is very simple. While we may understand through nature's processes, everything is there in its place and going about. Imagine if things start working randomly and chaotically. Of course, we can explain it by the process of nature, but what directed the process of nature in such a way that everything is in its place? So, and the sun is not static, it is also shifting. So we have to keep that in mind. The whole planetary system is shifting in galaxy. There is nothing static here. So he says, I first gave it to Vivaswan. So Vivaswan is the one who is the master controller of all these suns and thereby of the planetary systems and thereby of all that is happening on them. So Vivaswan in turn gives it to Manu. So who is Manu? So Manu is again the king of mankind for each age. So there is a prototype in the typal world, in the mind worlds, and his work is to lead mankind through a process of evolution. So for each age or cycle, Manu will give something, transmit it to the kings. And how he will transmit it? Not by coming there and speaking about it, but he will give it to the king as a kind of received knowledge. They will feel inspired, they will feel moved to write something, and that's how the kings start governing. Because for each age, and it will change, it's not a fixed book forever. So for this cycle of time, we have the seventh Manu, and this Aurobindo speaks of in Record of Yoga. He speaks about the Manus elsewhere also, he has spoken. So it's very interesting that, you know, for this cycle there was a Manu Smriti, which is now changing because now we are entering another cycle. So for this cycle, the name of the Manu is Shraddhadev, and they are all Manus are mental child of Brahma. Brahma's thought manifests as Manu. Manu is a being on the subtle plane and he governs the kings. Then what does Manu do? Manu will transmit it first to the kings. So in the beginning, there is a king, there is a lineage called the Solar Dynasty. So the Solar Dynasty is the Suryavanshis. So meaning there are three dynasties in India. Basically two, later on it branches into three. So they are the Suryavanshis. From the Suryavanshis, by conjunction with Buddha or Mercury, not the planet, but each of them is an entity, there comes the Chandravanshi dynasties, and from Chandravanshis there are the Yaduvanshis, which of which Sri Krishna himself is a part. So original is the Suryavanshis, and the Suryavanshi king is Ikshvaku. In the clan of Ikshvaku, there are many great kings. Sagar, who brings down the Ganges, Shivi, who sacrifices himself for the sake of a pigeon, saving a pigeon. Then, of course, Bhagirathi, Bhagirath, who brings down the Ganges. Sagar, who is a great pious person who conducts the Ashwamedh Yagya. And Raghu, the lineage of Raghu, immortalized by Kalidas. And they are all great warriors who are always living for dharma. That's how Sri Aurobindo describes in his translation of Raghuvansham of Kalidas. He has translated literally. They say they were born only for dharma and protecting the dharma. So these are the great kings, Raja Harishchandra, who sacrifices everything of himself for the sake of truthfulness. So each is an outstanding example. In that same lineage, Rama comes. So Ram is a Suryavanshi king. And so he says, I gave it to the Ikshvaku, who is the first king in the solar line. Then he says, over a period of time, this yoga got lost. And later on, now in this age, I am reviving this yoga and giving it to you. Now, it's very interesting, not only from the point of view of the Gita, in the Gita, Sri Krishna declares this, but it's very interesting because if we see this yoga getting lost and Sri Krishna reviving it and giving it to Arjun, we see something exactly happening again in this age. That this yoga is lost. So in India, which is the land of yogins, everybody is either reading the scriptures, going to the temples, doing all that, you know, Diyabatti, Puja, or people are going into the forest. Yogi means minimum clothes, and you should be living in forest, you should have no family, nothing. That's how a yogi was understood, otherworldly. So yoga was lost, and that's why we see over a period of time, slowly, India was occupied by all kinds of forces. They came basically to challenge, where is your yoga, where is your yoga? And we didn't understand. Because when the adversary challenges you, it challenges that where is your strength? After all adversity is a challenge to bring out your strength. Where is your strength? Do you have strength? No, we have knowledge, we can give a nice lecture. No, we don't want lecture. We want strength. Where is strength? So, slowly we see with that typical Vedanta, meditation, otherworldly, it degenerated. And Sri Aurobindo says that he analyzes the cause, or rather reveals the cause in Bhavani Mandir pamphlet, where he says why India fell. And he says India fell for want of Shakti. So we have bhakti plenty. We have knowledge plenty. But we lack Shakti. So he speaks, awakens the Shakti through Bhavani Bharati, through Durga Strot, and you know, through his writings, he awakens the Shakti. And his whole sadhana, if you see, at one level is a Shakti sadhana. Divine Mother, the supramental force, transforming mankind. So that Shakti has been missing. So which we see now, Sri Aurobindo once again coming and giving the yoga, which was lost after Arjuna's time, slowly it got lessened and lessened, till finally it was lost in the cycle of time. And Sri Aurobindo is reviving it again, we may say, Sri Krishna, as Sri Aurobindo is reviving it again. So this example is significant. That's how this chapter starts. Sri Krishna says that, you know, this is the yoga. I just read it. We are on chapter 15, page 145. Krishna has declared in passing that this was the ancient and original yoga which he gave to Vivaswan, the sun god. Vivaswan gave it to Manu, the father of men. Manu gave it to Ikshvaku, head of the solar line. And so it came down from royal sage to royal sage. It was given to royal sage, kings and sages, because kings are involved in governance. And they have to be sage-like. Royal sage to royal sage, till it was lost in the great lapse of time. And now renewed for Arjun. Now, why it is being renewed for Arjun? That's also important. What's so special about Arjun? People often ask, because Arjun has his own, he's like a very regular guy, except that he is very professional. You know, he is technically sound. If you tell him to shoot an arrow, in dark he could shoot. He is the only character in the entire Mahabharata. He could shoot on target in the dark and without those infrared goggles. Okay, so he had that capability because he had practiced like that. Of course, he could shoot by hearing where, you know, there were many such practices. So Arjun is the sharpest shooter, not just the sharp shooter. And he has gone to extreme limits of perfection in his skills. So we can say the lower perfection. He is also a sattvic man. So he discusses, debates, why I should raise, bow and arrow against my own people. So he's not just a, in spite of all these skills, he's not just, a sword brandishing person who is just ready to hit or aggress anyone just because he is capable. So he's saying now he's giving to Arjun. But why he's giving to Arjun, that is important, because he's the lover and devotee. Friend and comrade of the avatar. He has fought the battle of the ages. Now Shri Krishna is revealing that, as Nar Narayan, we both have fought for the great battle of the ages. Like Sri Aurobindo once reveals this for Charu Chandra Dutt. I think I was mentioning this during the Darshan speech, that when Charu Chandra Dutt, they were together in the freedom struggle, and Sri Aurobindo came away. He came away because what had to be done was done, and there was a greater work, much greater work. So Sri Krishna tells him that I have a much greater work for you. This is done now. And he had gone far ahead in the freedom struggle. His thoughts were moving like blazing meteors. So then when he comes here, so Charu Chandra Dutt and many of his compatriots, they were very annoyed, angry. Why he left us? Why the chief has left us? So they got very annoyed, and he was very cross with Sri Aurobindo. But he was very unhappy inside, and his wife tells him, see, why don't you go and meet your chief in Pondicherry? Everybody goes and gets peace. Why don't you go? He said, no, I will not go. I'm angry with him. So, of course, this is a friendly anger. Huh? So, Dilip Kumar Roy tells Sri Aurobindo, do you know this C.C. Dutt? It seems he knows you, but do you remember him? He says, oh, Charu, yes, I remember him. He is one of those front rank of humanity with whom I have fought the battle of the ages. In this life, I have not yet been able to call him. My own preoccupations, I suppose. When this is told to Charu, he is touched. He remembers me. So his wife tells him, see. So finally he goes there, and just as an interesting aside, so he had burnt away many of things Sri Aurobindo had given him, letters, everything. So now he had the Gita which Sri Aurobindo had read in Alipur jail, or that Gita Sri Aurobindo had given to Charu. So Charu said, who knows my mind, this is the only gift I can give back. So he goes and gives it back, tells mother, please keep it in safe custody. It is Sri Aurobindo had given it to me. Mother said, okay. Next day, mother called him and said, Sri Aurobindo has told, once I had given this Gita to him, now again, I am giving him this Gita from my side. So that's the whole connection, battle of the ages. So he says to Arjun, I am giving to you because you love me. You are my lover and devotee. That's the adhikar of this yoga. Yoga is not, why lover and devotee? Why not to a jnani? See, jnanis are always, many jnanis, their seeking will get mixed with doubt. Lover and devotee will receive it just like this. And lover and devotee, as Sri Aurobindo would say, is the crown. Because when you love someone, you become like that person. That's the beauty of love. Only love can do that. Shortcut to change. So he says, I am giving you because you are my lover and devotee, friend and comrade. For this, he says, is the highest secret. So there are three secrets in the Gita. This is the first secret Sri Krishna is revealing, and that is about his avatarhood. Second is that he dwells in the heart of all creatures, and there is a path through which one can discover him. And the third is that if you surrender unconditionally to him, he takes you up unconditionally and liberates you from all fear. And these are the three secrets. So first secret, the highest secret, Sri Krishna is revealing to him. Thus claiming for it a superiority to all other forms of yoga, because those others lead to the impersonal Brahman or to a personal deity, to a liberation in actionless knowledge or a liberation in absorbed beatitude. But this gives the highest secret and the whole secret. It brings us to divine peace and divine works, to divine knowledge, action and ecstasy, unified in a perfect freedom. It unites into itself all the yogic paths as the highest being of the divine reconciles and makes one in itself all the different and even contrary powers and principles of its manifested being. So the Gita is in the nature of a synthesis. Whatever was known that time, he takes it up and gives a great truth. And that great truth is about the divine not just being a power. Very often in modern times, yes, we believe there is a power called God. Some will say there is a state of consciousness, super conscient. Now just imagine the folly of human reason. Superconscious state means whatever that state of consciousness is fully aware. Not only of everything else but also of itself. If I am aware of myself in whatever limited way, I am a being. As simple as that. How do I say I exist? Because I am aware of myself. It's not just because of the body. I may have a body, but I may be unconscious. So that time, I don't know myself. But I am aware I exist. Whatever one may prove, not prove, but this awareness that there is a self, of course a very limited self, ego self, but there is the sense of a self is what a being is. By nature, being is whose? That which is aware of itself. You may not be aware. I may not be aware of some being somewhere outside, roaming outside the Savitri Bhavan, but I know myself. So the divine is a being. The difference is that he is not only aware of himself, he is aware of all creatures, because from that being, all other beings are derived. We are all chinna chinna, small small beings out of that one being. So this is the first secret. Second is that this being is not up above, governing in absentio, but this being dwells in our heart. So the question arises, how does he govern then? We don't seem to be living life according to this being. And so he will reveal that to us. But first we'll go step by step. Page 146, Sri Krishna reveals to him, many are my lives that are past, and thine also, O Arjun. All of them I know, but thou knowest not. O scourge of the foe. This is one of the words used for Arjun is parantapa. Scourge of the foes. When he, you know, puts the string of the bow, his bow, Gandhi, and just, you know, pulls it across. It is said that by the sound of that great bow, people's heart were, you know, thrilled with fear, because here is Arjun. They know that, you know, if he is in the battlefield, they don't stand a chance. Even the greatest of warriors. So that is how he is parantapa. So on the battlefield, he addresses him that thus, though I am unborn, though I am the unborn, though I am imperishable in my self-existence, though I am the lord of all existences, yet I stand upon my own nature and I come into birth by my self Maya. So here ordinarily he is seated in the heart, but we don't know him. Why? Because he is veiled by the self Maya. It is his Maya. His Maya has veiled himself. Why it has veiled himself? Simply because we won't be able to bear that intensity, that measureless measure. Sri Krishna is described by only one word indicating that he is divine by Vyasa in Mahabharata. Later on in Purana, all his Leela comes. And that word is aparime. You cannot measure him. There is no way you can measure him. He is measureless. So what does Yoga Maya does? It measures. Maya is the power that measures the infinite and into finite name, form, shape. This is the first step. The second step is it makes the consciousness limited in that little prison, and therefore I believe I am limited. So there are two sides of this Maya. One where the Maya, the Vidyamay Maya, it limits but is conscious. It's like somebody who is measuring out this dose, that dose of medicine, but it knows it's the same medicine. It's the matra. The word, they are similar word. They come from the same root. Ma, mata, matra, which we use for medicines. Maya, they all have the same root. You measure out this medicine, but take this much only, one spoon. Don't take more. So if you take more, what will happen? The same medicine will kill you. So the divine measures himself out in doses that creation can receive him. Imagine that power, that effulgence, that knowledge, that love. Even little love and ananda, we go berserk. Oh, India has won the match. Bas, that's enough to go, make us go crazy. Oh, I'm in love. And people are, you know, jumping, running around. Now imagine if that love, that intensity of ananda floods us, what's going to happen? That's why in Savitri, when Ashupati is at the gates of the eternal, the Divine Mother's voice tells him, my fire and sweetness are the cause of life, but too immense my danger and my delight, too immense. And then he says, truth born too soon might break the imperfect earth. Man is too weak to bear the infinite sweet. Imagine suddenly we stand before a truth that all your measures, your rules, moral rules, ethical rules, societal rules, government rules, they are all basically all constructs of the mind, but they don't have a fundamental truth about them. Imagine what chaos can happen. This is a little story of Sri Aurobindo. Somebody speaks to Sri Aurobindo and says, so and so, about one disciple is saying about another. He says, you know, somebody who used to be a thief, used to steal from government offices, and now, you know, he has come here. Then the other disciple says, now he is stealing flowers from this garden, that garden. So Sri Aurobindo says, all wealth, all who hold it are thieves. Now you see, that's a different vision. It's not yours. You believe it's yours and you are spending it freely, you are a thief. That's how Sri Aurobindo writes in a letter to Mrilani Devi that up till now I have lived like a thief. Out of 16 annas that God gives me, I use only 2 annas for God and 14 annas I keep to myself. Now this is another vision, that they are all thieves. So it's a question of a thief stealing a thief. Now you see, if you... philanthropist, he says something like, robber assuaging his conscience out of guilt. You have, philanthropist, you have amassed money by all kinds of means, which you justify. Now you are giving it for some work, Bill Gates Foundation, this one. Now after stealing, he says, it's robber justifying his conscience. Okay, I am giving something of what I have stolen. Now when you live in that measureless state, we will be confused. That's why Sri Krishna says in the beginning, don't confuse the minds. Those who have realized, they don't confuse, because people have to go through steps and stages. They can't jump suddenly. And therefore, he veils himself by his yoga maya. So each one he reveals only that much that we are ready. That's why at one place Mother says, one must reach me after a long period of practice and evolution. And when you reach her, then you realize that this is infinity putting on a human shape. But now the difference is, while he is veiled by the yoga maya in ordinary humanity, he presses upon the maya to form a shape and body where he dwells now consciously. That is the difference. Ordinarily in everyone the divine is present, but he is hidden. But when the divine consciously assumes a human body, pressing upon his own Maya. Now here is, he's not coming under the Maya, besieged by her, who forgets who he is. But he is asking Maya to shape a body for himself, a mind for himself, because he wants to don it. And he's telling Maya, this is the work I have got to do. So accordingly you have to shape it. Look at Sri Aurobindo, you know, the work that he had to do. His body and mind is formed like that. The mother, and at one place she says that it took last 6 months of the mother because her body was formed in a very special way, and it described in Savitri that, you know, it was formed in a very special way. A life of rhythmic force, a mind of light, all this is described. Why? Because then the work for which she has come to help mankind and earthly life cross, that can be effectuated. So it is a special way that the mind and body of the avatar is formed. It will be limited because all will be limited. But here he is fully conscious of the God. It will not veil. That will be a conscious that there is the divine presence which will manifest over a period of time with the development of the mind and body. So that's how when people ask the mother about the mother, Sri Aurobindo says the mother was inwardly conscious about the divine even as a child. But as she grows, it manifests itself. As the mother herself says, first thing what she was conscious of, she says consciousness as Shakti. Then, you know, as the body and mind develop, they have been shaped in a certain way. For the deliverance, why does he come? Loose forth into work. For whenever there is the fading of the dharma and the uprising of unrighteousness, then I lose myself forth into birth. For the deliverance of the good, for the destruction of the evildoers, for the enthroning of the right, I am born from age to age. This Sri Aurobindo will elaborate at great length in chapter 17. So we'll wait for that moment. He who knoweth thus in its right principles my divine birth and my divine work, when he abandons his body, comes not to rebirth, he comes to me. O Arjun. So what is the secret? He tells him, you want to be delivered from this ignorance, this evil, sin tendencies. Because Arjun's question is, if I shoot arrows and my own people will be killed, I'll commit a sin. I don't want to roast in hell. So he says, I'll give you the secret. What is the secret? Delivered from liking and fear and wrath, full of me, madbhavam, taking refuge in me, many purified by austerity of knowledge have arrived at my nature of being. As men approach me, so I accept them to my love. Men follow in every way my path, O son of Pritha. So basically, mother describes it in very interesting way in Collected Works, Volume 9. So she says that lot of catastrophes are going to take place. She says that, you know, because sections of mankind are going to be destroyed, which is perverse. Some will be absorbed back into the animal kingdom, simplicity of the animal life. But there are those who are ready, who will be lifted up into the supramental creation. That may take a few centuries, as she has said. But she says something very interesting. And it is not about knowing intellectually. There are those who just have faith in the about the divine sacrifice in matter. They do not know that, you know, where the sacrifice took place, what that sacrifice is, who did it. But they just have faith that the divine has assumed a human body. Now, it may look like a credulous doctrine, but see, it's very interesting. Despite our 1,000 limitations and the need of divine constantly in our life, it's so difficult for a human being to accept that God can take a human body. But there are some who are just endowed with this faith. It's a treasure. That's all I'll say. It's a gift. Who don't have this question? Not that they are fools. They're not stupid people. You know, men like Swami Vivekananda, Sri Aurobindo, they have, even by every yardstick of intelligence, they are way beyond average humanity. And yet, for them it comes very naturally, the divine taking a human body. So there are people like that. who very spontaneously they have this faith. And why it is so? Because their psychic being is developed, if you put it like that. So we look at human intellectual achievements and degrees, but the divine looks at the psychic being. A developed psychic being will recognize the divine. And when it recognizes the divine, that's the end of the matter. So that's what Sri Krishna says very categorically, that they come to me, their nature changes into my divine nature. That is the great assurance. And then of course he says that there are others who follow different paths, but ultimately at the end they will find me because I am the one who has let forth. Now he is talking in that state where he is the divine who has assumed a human body. And that should be very clear, that it's not just Krishna as the physical form, but at that moment he is revealing his highest self to Arjun and to all of us. Works affect me not, nor have I desire for the fruit of works. I am reading those in inverted commas, page 147. He who thus knows me is not bound by his works. So knows him how? Knows him as both the impersonal Brahman and the truth beyond, and assuming a human body. At one place somebody asked Sri Aurobindo about the mother. He says, yes, but why should we believe in this mother? Individual mother. Mother is there. Universal mother, Jagan Mata, Jagat Dhatri, all this we know. Ya Devi, Sarva Bhuteshu, Shakti Rupen, Sanstita. Why this mother? So Sri Aurobindo says, do not be besieged by this asuric maya, adverse asuric maya, which creates an illusion that it is this mother is different and there is that universal mother, and yoga can be done without this mother. It will be done by the universal mother, which creates a division between this and that. That manifesting as this by its own will, that is the great secret. So he is revealing this one by one. So knowing was work done by the men of old, who sought liberation. Do therefore thou also work of that more ancient kind done by ancient men. And this we can see in Auroville and ashram context in a different way. So when people come to ashram or Auroville, we can apply the same logic. So you ask, what are you doing? You'll find these two, three kinds of people. One is those who have come, they like the work. I like Auroville, so I'm working here. I'm just exploring, stuff like that. And there will be one group, small group. They say, we have come for the mother and we are doing mother's work. Doesn't matter. You see the difference. People often ask, why did you join the ashram? What is so special about you? You were doing work in Air Force. I said, I have not joined an institution. Who told you? Then, I have come for the mother. Now, when you have that attitude that you are working for the mother, then everything changes. Actually, the entire scenario changes. All difficulties become joyous. All challenges become evolutionary processes. Because you're not working for an organization will change. Institutions will change. Today you will see one activity going on. There are people, a lot of people who get frustrated. This is happening in Auroville. That is happening in Auroville. That is irrelevant. These are waves which will go. All institutions will go through changes, ups and downs. What is the constant? It is mother's land. Therefore one works. That's period. So it gives you a different impetus, a different joy, a different connect. Because you're not working for a organization, for a institution, for some people. No, you're working for mother. So things will change outwardly, but mother is the constant. So thus one gets liberated. Now Sri Aurobindo reveals here the great purpose of the avatar in a very interesting way. Last line. But we have to remark carefully that the upholding of dharma in the world is not the only object of the descent of the avatar, that great mystery of the divine manifest in humanity. This dharma siglani abhyutthanam dharmasya tadatma shijamayam we'll touch in after another two chapters. But here he is saying the key. What is the key? Because upholding of dharma can be done by great leaders, by vibhutis, saints and sages. That great mystery of the divine manifest in humanity, for the upholding of the dharma is not an all-sufficient object in itself, not the supreme possible aim for the manifestation of a Christ, a Krishna, a Buddha, but is only the general condition of a higher aim and a more supreme and divine utility. Why dharma at all? Dharma is the law of divine unfolding. What is its purpose? Its purpose is so that our whole nature can become one with the divine supernature. So that is the whole idea. So that's why the dharma. Otherwise, why should one, you know, follow dharma? Page 148. We are reading 4th-5th line from above. For there are two aspects of the divine birth. One is a descent, the birth of God in humanity, the Godhead manifesting itself in the human form and nature, the eternal avatar. The other is an ascent, the birth of man into the Godhead, man rising into the divine nature and consciousness. Madbhavam agataha. It is the being born anew in a second birth of the soul. It is that new birth which avatarhood and the upholding of the dharma are intended to serve. Meaning thereby, if anybody asks us, who are you? Even in sleep, and we know we are mother's child. That's our only identity. We are no more Mr. So-and-so, Dr. So-and-so, I am big man. That's why these positions of power are most dangerous. People get carried away. I am so-and-so, don't you know me? It's very difficult to be humble. Of course, if you can be humble there and serve, it's something beautiful. Not even the ego of the instrument, but just the only identity is I am mother's child. And to live in that mother's consciousness, think of her, work for her. When there is nothing to do, take delight in her. Madbhavam, ma bhavam. Just changing. Ma bhavam, ma gataha. Read about her. So slowly your nature begins to become like hers. That's why she takes a human form. Otherwise very difficult to contact her. Inside, world over, we'll have all our imaginations and make all kinds of figures. But when she becomes human, comes within the range of our mortal existence, our mortal vision, our audible range, now all this is to draw us towards the mother. And anything which can make a contact. So sometimes when you hear mother's French, so people ask, do you understand French? I say, that's irrelevant. Of course, if I understand, it will be beautiful. But look at the sweetness of her voice. What is happening? You are coming in contact with mother's voice. And mother's voice means through her voice, through her consciousness. That's all that is required. Yoga is contact with the divine, and then thereby this contact grows and grows. You become a friend of the divine. You become a lover of the divine. Because contact is the beginning point. First you passingly see hello. And then you start, you know, exchanging some gifts, and then you one day shake hand. And the other day you say, oh, this hand? And then one day you touch the feet, and then she embraces you, and then a time comes when you begin to live. This is what yoga is about, as simple as that. It's not something very complicated. Sit like this and do this mantra and sit bolt straight and do this. Living in the divine mother, that is the yoga. So he is saying this is the purpose. New birth. Being birth, new born as a child of the divine mother. This is Sri Aurobindo's letter. One may have achieved astounding siddhis in the physical. One may have brilliant illuminations of the mind. One may have many vital powers, occult powers. But if one has not become a child newborn to the Divine Mother, then this yoga cannot be done. His letter is there. You can't do this yoga otherwise. You may have exalted humankind, maybe a saint or sage or whatever. But what she is going to give us is something much greater. To become one in nature with the Divine. To become the divine, if you want to put it squarely. So, Next para. If there were not this rising of man into the Godhead to be helped by the descent of God into humanity, avatarhood for the sake of the dharma would be an otiose phenomenon. Since mere right, mere justice or standards of virtue can always be upheld by the divine omnipotence through its ordinary means, by great men or great movements, by the life and work of sages and kings and religious leaders, teachers, without any actual incarnation. As we see, Shivaji, he upheld the Hindu dharma. He says that I am fighting for that. And he conquered. He took back so much from the Mughals. So that's many. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he by his, you know, fervor brought so much bhakti once again in India. So that can be done by them. Why avatar is needed? The avatar comes as the manifestation of the divine nature in the human nature. That's why you can't speak of Shri Aurobindo. I mean, one can speak whatever they want, as of course thinker, philosopher is to bring many layers down, but even Sant, Rishi, Maharishi, Rajarshi, none of these. But plain and simple, Shri Aurobindo. So that's how it is. Have you heard Rishi Shri Krishna? It will sound very odd. Sant Purush Maha Shri Krishna. 108 bar Shri Krishna. You will find Shri Krishna will laugh. He'll feel amused. He say, can you not leave me just as Krishna, 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 Krishna? So, the avatar comes as the manifestation of the divine nature, the apocalypse of its Christhood, Krishnahood, Buddhahood, in order that the human nature may, by molding its principle, thought, feeling, action, being on the lines of that Christhood, Krishnahood, Buddhahood, transfigure itself into the divine. The law, the dharma which the avatar establishes is given for that purpose, chiefly. So, wherever we see that the example was either not there or was lost, and only the book was left, you will see that there is the degeneration. But wherever the divine example is kept intact, that's why the Gita says, which we read last time, that Shri Krishna says, my example, it's so important. So, that is why each incarnation holds before man his own example and declares of himself that he is the way and the gate. He declares to the oneness of his humanity with the divine being, declares that the Son of Man and the Father above, from whom he has descended, are one, that Krishna in the human body, Manushim, Tanum, Ashritam, and the Supreme Lord and Friend of all creatures are but two revelations of the same divine Purushottama, revealed there in his own being, revealed here in the type of humanity. How beautiful it is that he who is hidden in the heart, whom we cannot see, but we have to just have faith and try and do all kinds of practice to go within, suddenly comes out, manifests. So when mother used to give meditation, so there would be people sitting on the left, people sitting on the right, and they would all, and somebody in front, they will close their eyes and meditate, and Amal Kiran will look at everybody, sometimes draw sketches, Purani ji, undermined by the overmind, such comments also he'll write. Somebody asks, why don't you close your eyes and meditate? He says, he whom I am going to search inside is sitting in front of me. Am I a fool to close my eyes and meditate? So you see what he says, deluded minds despise me, lost in the human body because they know not my supreme nature of being, Lord of all existence. So all this becomes very difficult for the modern mind, and Shri Krishna tackles all these aspects one by one. But important thing is page 150 in the middle. So first he says, the rationalist objects that if God exists, he is extra-cosmic or supra-cosmic and does not intervene in the affairs of the world. Why? Because he sees the world as it is, or he says, how can he, that consciousness too vast and power, but he cannot, looking at the world, cannot imagine that he is intervening in the world. But allows them to be governed by a fixed machinery of law. So why he doesn't straight away reveal himself? For the same reason. Sudden revelation of that ultimate truth will break down humanity. So step by step through all the challenges, just as an individual yoga takes place step by step, So does the national yoga and the world yoga take place step by step. The individual yoga is always in the forefront. The national yoga is next step and the world yoga is the last step. So that's why the world progresses slowly. If you look at the world, we'll see many things which are just like our own nature individually. It takes time. So this is the process of his progressive self-revelation. But what we have to remember is, but allows them to be governed by a fixed machinery of law. He is, in fact, a sort of, so rationalist thinks that he has just made some laws and that's how it goes. And as far as God is concerned, he is a sort of far-off constitutional monarch or spiritual king, log, at the best an indifferent, inactive spirit behind the activity of nature. But here, what is he saying? Sri Krishna, no, I assume a human birth. Now, the simplest of logic is that if the divine wants to assume a birth, who are we to stop him? If he is omnipotent and omniscient, omnipotent, can he not do this? Or shall we say he is omnipotent, but he can't do this? Arya Samajis object like that. There are some Vedantins also who object like that. Well, if he is omnipotent, then cannot infinite limit himself into finite form and name? And then Shubhinda says, in fact, that's what Vedanta ultimately means. That there is the infinite consciousness which has limited itself in many forms and names and dwells also in the human being. So if it can do thus far, why cannot the infinite consciously assume a human body and step in the forefront of the quest? So all that we will see that he develops, page 151, last line. For far from being from the unborn being unable to assume birth, all beings are even in their individuality unborn spirits, eternal without beginning or end, and in their essential existence and their universality. All are the unborn spirit of whom birth and death are only a phenomenon of the assumption and change of form. So birth always meant in Indian thought limiting oneself. That's what birth means. Infinite limits. So it becomes born and then dies. Because when you limit, it delimits, dies. But it always remains infinite. It's like infinite, anything, any power, energy, you limit it. Flow of water or sunlight, you limit it through the solar panels and you light up. So if something happens to the solar panels, the light doesn't come. Does it mean that the sun has stopped giving light? That's how we have to see that all birth is a limitation of the infinite. And for that, mechanisms have been created for various purposes. And then comes these powerful lines. Page 152. The assumption of imperfection by the perfect is the whole mystic phenomena of the universe. And a few lines below. Nor does God rule the world from some remote heaven, but by his intimate omnipresence, each finite working of force is an act of infinite force. Now we remember those lines in Savitri where Sri Aurobindo beautifully reveals us the absolute, the perfect, the immune. Our mask of imperfection has assumed his measure in the human measure cast, so that into his divine nature we may rise. A mutual debt binds God man to the supreme. His human portion, we must grow divine. Our life is a paradox with God for key. So this, in those lines, he gives us the mystery of the avatar, the mystic truth. So, and all this is simultaneous. So when he assumes a human body, doesn't mean he has shifted from here. He is here in the heart as well, because he is infinite. If he is finite, then he has to shift from here and take a human body. He is infinite. He can multiply in numberless bodies because he is infinite. So he continues to be present in the heart of all creatures. He continues to be in these transcendent heavens. He continues to be governing the universal movement. And he also takes a human body for a special work. And that special work is to lift man into his Godhead. So I think we'll stop here. We'll just read a few lines from page 155. So he describes all this in great detail, and then he says how he enters. He says, I press upon my own nature. So, swabhava and swadharma. That's how he limits himself in every creature. But when it comes to taking a human body, he presses upon the same nature. So what it means is that somebody creates the mold. Let's say Maya creates the molds in which human souls enter. So there is a parents who are creating the mold by heredity, and the souls enter into it. This is the normal process. So it gets veiled by the yog maya. What does divine do? He calls yog maya and says, make a mold for me. Where, sir, where do you want the mold to be made? You make it in Devaki's womb. I have first to sort out something with Kansa. Why Devaki's womb? I have given her a boon long back. You don't question all this. You make it. Okay. So, now you see the story of Kansa, that why after 7 children or 6 children, suddenly there is birth of yog maya. So it's a mystic story where Kans tries to kill her, but you cannot kill her. And she tells that, you know, you don't know, he is already born. And forming. Why? Because she is the one who has formed. She knows. So she declares. All others forget. Even Devaki forgets that, you know, it is the divine who took birth. But she knows. She says he is born, he is growing up happily, healthily. He is going to kill you. Prophecy will be fulfilled. As simple as that. Do whatever you may do. So while others come under yog maya and forget, he comes and calls yog maya. This is the womb, and this is the poem of Sri Aurobindo. A strong son of lightning came and entered the womb of darkness. You see this mystery, how the avatar takes a human birth. A short poem. That how he takes human birth, lets himself. After the body is formed, then he enters. But it's a conscious birth. But of course, the instrument will always be limited. But this instrument, through its limitation, has to exceed its limitations. Take the next step. So then, as it will exceed the limitation through the progressive revelation of the divine, other human beings who are full of the divine, open to the divine, also will start getting into that mold. This is how the whole process of yoga of transformation works. Leaning upon my own nature, prakartim swam avastabhya. So that's how he says, I press, coerce, this what I want. It will say later, I loose forth variously, visrajami, this multitude of creatures, helplessly subject owing to the control of prakriti. Avasham, prakritim, vasat, they are under the control of prakriti. Standing upon my own nature, it says here, I am born by myself, Maya. This is the difference. So on one side, he says, leaning upon my own nature, I loose forth variously the multitude of creatures, helplessly subject owing to the control of prakriti. Standing upon my own nature, I am born by myself, Maya. I loose forth myself. The action implied in the word avastabhya is a forceful downward pressure by which the object controlled is overcome, oppressed, blocked or limited in its movement or working and becomes helplessly subject to the controlling power. On the contrary, the action implied in the word adhisthaya, I am the Lord, is a dwelling in but also a standing upon and over the nature, a conscious control and government by the indwelling Godhead, in which the Purusha is not helplessly driven by the Prakriti through ignorance, but rather the Prakriti is full of the light and the will of the Purusha. It's the same difference when you stay in a house as a tenant and when you are the owner. So tenant can't create changes. He has to pay the tax. He is bound by the design and pattern of the house. But if you are the owner, you decide what kind of house you want to make to start with. You want to make the changes, you want to raise the house to ground and make it again, you can do it. So that is the difference between ordinary humanity, which is like a tenant living in a house of flesh, paying its tax to the night and to Maya because they are formed. But when God comes, takes a human birth, he is not the tenant, he is the owner. So when death comes and time comes, says, sir, tax, I'll give you, not just for me, I'll give the tax for the whole of humanity. At least those who are ready, now I want to change their house. Sir, that house I had built, I know, but who are you? You are my own child. I am the owner. These houses I am going to rebuild. That's how transformation takes place. The Divine Mother takes charge of certain houses, certain minds, starts rebuilding them, molding them. Why? Because now she has taken those houses. But ordinarily we can't do it because we have to pay a tax, call it whatever, law of karma or whatever. So the Divine takes a human form and picks up and changes. It is by myself, Maya, not the involution in the lower Maya of the ignorance, but the conscious action of the self-existent Godhead in its phenomenal self-representation, well aware of its operation and its purpose, that which the Gita calls elsewhere Yog Maya. The avatar, last line, the avatar below, 4 or 5 lines from below, the avatar therefore is a direct manifestation in humanity by Krishna, the divine soul of that divine condition of being to which Arjun, the human soul, the type of a highest human being, a vibhuti, is called upon by the teacher to arise, and to which he can only arise by climbing out of the ignorance and limitation of his ordinary humanity. It is the manifestation from above of that which we have to develop from below. It is the descent of God into that divine birth of the human being into which we mortal creatures must climb. It is the attracting divine example given by God to man in the very type and form of and perfected model of our human existence. And Mother was asked, what is the divine? And she said, the divine is what we adore in Sri Aurobindo. We feel that, no? Why do we feel that? No definitions, nothing. Sri Aurobindo is divine. Mother is divine. And if that experience has come even for a moment, one is finished. That is the essence. That's what the Gita is saying, Sri Aurobindo is telling us. Because already there is, at a fundamental level, the revelation has taken place. This is what I must become. And then, once you are caught in that flame, your little fire is taken up and the little body and mind and heart are shaped into the perfect Godhead of which they are the first born of the human race. Okay, thank you.